And there are a couple of things behind it. One is these kinds of laws were designed to protect the mom and pop operation against the evils of the chain store. There were these chain stores who were going to come into town, sell things below cost, drive the mom and pop retailers out of business, and that wasn't deemed to be fair. So the state built in a certain profit margin that every retailer in the state had to abide by. You were not allowed to sell your product for cheaper than a certain amount, otherwise you would get in a lot of trouble. And the Wisconsin law for fuel, well, just let me say one more thing about the history of that. It's partly to protect the mom and pop, but it's also a Depression era law, similar to a lot of the New Deal legislation. If you're like me, when you were in law school, you read the Schechter case, also known as the sick chicken case. And you know, you read this and you were thinking about, you know, what the federal government may and may not regulate. But if you're like me, when you finished reading that case, you thought to yourself, oh, wait a minute, what do all these regulations about sick chickens have to do with ending the Depression? Well, what they had to do with ending the Depression was that the thought was that one of the causes of the Great Depression was just unfettered, unbridled, cutthroat competition. That was kind of perceived as one of the causes of the Depression. So what a lot of this New Deal legislation tried to do was kind of shackle and fetter the competition just a little bit to kind of even things out for everybody so it wouldn't be quite so cutthroat. It was thought that would end the Depression. Well, it would be kind of unfair competition, I guess, if I opened up a meat market and I put a big sign in front of my store that says, "We don't sell sick chickens here." And that would be unfair competition because the meat market across the street, well, some of their sick chickens are sick. So if you're a consumer, you're probably gonna come to my place because you know you're gonna get a good chicken, and the place across the street, you're gonna get a sick one. Well, if we wanna put a chicken in every pot, there are only so many chickens to go around, so some people have to take the sick ones. So we have to somehow fairly allocate those. And the way we did that was this regulation in New York was set up saying that a retailer has to, you know, pick chickens at random and you can't pick out the good ones and leave the sick ones behind for the other guy. So kind of tempering competition a little bit was thought that would end the Depression. And that's kind of what's going on here. If I'm selling fuel just at a razor-thin margin, that's not really fair for the guy across the street. It's unfair competition. So we need to build in these minimum markups. Well, there's another set of federal law, and this was a state law, Wisconsin Unfair Sales Act. There's another set of federal laws, though, from an earlier era called the antitrust laws. Like the Sherman Act. And you know, here we have this Unfair Sales Act saying you and all your competitors have to keep the prices high. Well, but then you have the Sherman Act saying, well, no, you can't conspire to fix prices. There has to be competition. So the Flying J, kind of the quintessential chain store of the truck stop industry, they flew into town and said, we want to open up a truck stop in Wisconsin and we can make a profit selling even below these minimum markups. We want to do it. And what you have here in the state of Wisconsin is a classic case of horizontal price fixing. And that's illegal under the Sherman Act. And we want an injunction against that so we can sell fuel for whatever price we want. Now, there was one other element of this Wisconsin law that they kind of seized upon to do that. Under the Wisconsin law, there was kind of a mathematical formula that a retailer could punch in their cost. You know, I paid this much on this day, and you could just calculate it, and you could calculate exactly what the minimum legal price was for fuel from your store. But there was kind of a safe harbor provision out there also. And what the safe harbor provision was, well, after you calculate this, if the guy across the street is selling it for lower than you, you can match that price. You can't go lower than it, but you can match the price across the street. And there was a specific procedure that they had to follow if they wanted to do that. You had to give some kind of notice to the stage or whatever, but there was a special procedure that was followed. Although there was no evidence that that was that special procedure was followed with any regularity. Most of the time, it seemed people were just crunching the numbers to get their minimum price and using that, and not using this safe harbor provision where they could match the price across the street. Well, the district court, they brought the suit in the district court in Wisconsin, and the district court agreed with them and said, yeah, this state law, this old 1939 law, this is preempted by the Sherman Act. This is unfair, or this is price fixing. The Sherman Act says that there should be heated competition to keep the prices low, and this statute does just the opposite. And the district court enjoined it. The Court of Appeals reversed it, and they remanded it to dissolve the injunction. I don't know if that's happened yet, so it might be your last chance in the next couple of days to get some cheap Wisconsin gas, but that's gone because the injunction will be dissolved, and the Court of Appeals said that no, that is not preempted because a state regulation like that is preempted by the federal law only if the state law either mandates or authorizes conduct that necessarily constitutes a violation of the antitrust laws. So here, for example, they took a look at this safe harbor provision saying you can match the price across the street. And yeah, I guess I can see there are some possibilities there that might make it easier for you to conspire with the guy across the street. It might make it easier to say, you make it $2.79, I'll match it. It makes it possible to conspire maybe, but it doesn't mandate that you violate the antitrust laws, nor does it even authorize conduct that constitutes a violation. So therefore, it is not preempted by federal law, and the state of Wisconsin can continue enforcing this law. Now we will not have time to cover every case that's in here. So if you happen to see something that was very interesting at the end, I'm going to kind of follow them in the order that they're given here. So if you saw one at the end that you thought was particularly interesting that you wanted to talk about, let me know and we can move to that one. But otherwise, I'll just continue in order. Chapin versus Fort Rohr Motors. We're talking about retaliation under the EEOC laws. The plaintiff in this case, Mr. Chapin, was a used car salesman. And he worked for a car dealer. It sounds kind of like the Denny Hecker of Indiana prior to some of his recent troubles here. But it was owned by one owner that owned a number of dealerships. They were all under separate corporate entities, but they were all owned by the same person. Well, he worked for one of these, and then he believed that he was discriminated against. In fact, he was fired from one of these dealers, and he thought that that was because of his race. He thought they were hiring only Pakistanis, and he was Anglo-American, and he thought that he was being discriminated against for that reason. So he filed an EEOC complaint. It doesn't talk too much about how far he had pursued that, but he filed this complaint. He got another job at another car dealer, which turned out to be one owned by the same owner, but different corporation. Well, his new boss caught wind of this EEOC complaint that he had filed against the previous employer that was kind of the sister car dealership, apparently the supervisor was not too amused by this. And there was a lot of colorful language. There was a meeting took place between him. The plaintiff brought along a tape recorder, so we have a verbatim transcript. But the supervisor told him, you need to reverse the claim right away, and it needs to be done today. And you're not going to work here until you go get it reversed. So he basically said, if you don't go change that EEOC case, you're fired. So the plaintiff said, okay, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. I'll go home and I'll undo that EEOC case so I can keep working here. Because he had been told, if you don't do it, you're fired. Well, he went home and apparently he thought about it a little bit, or for whatever reason, he decided he was not going to withdraw his EEOC complaint. And he decided not to go back to work because the boss told him, if you don't do this, you're fired. So he assumed he was fired. But he didn't call up and say, boss, I refuse to withdraw that EEOC complaint, and I guess I don't work for you anymore. And he didn't call up and say, I quit. I can't work here anymore. He didn't quit. He didn't resign. All there was this, you aren't going to work here until you do this. And for something that he didn't do. So he assumed that he was fired. He sued for retaliation because one of the grounds for discrimination, if you file an EEOC complaint and your employer retaliates against you for doing so, that's actionable, even if the underlying complaint, as long as it was in good faith, the underlying complaint doesn't necessarily have to be valid. So here he said, well, I was fired because in good faith I filed this EEOC complaint, and I even have a tape recorder here that says, you aren't going to work here until you get it reversed, period. The jury was a pretty solid case. I doubt if the jury was out too long on that one. And they returned a verdict in his favor, saying, yeah, you were retaliated against. The Court of Appeals reversed it because, yeah, the boss said, basically, if you don't withdraw your complaint, you will be fired. Those aren't the exact words that he used, but that's more or less what he said. Yeah, it was discriminatory perhaps, but you were not terminated, nor was there a constructive discharge. Now, and what they said was a reasonable employee would not believe that firing was an imminent and inevitable event, even though they said, if you don't do this, you're fired. One of the facts that entered into it pretty heavily, so just is the fact that maybe this boss talked to his lawyers a little bit after saying that, and